on 2FM. With Green Farm, B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6.
On 2FM.
Yes, a big thank you to the two Johnnies for another entertaining afternoon. It's Monday the 25th of April and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly chat association football as Liverpool keep the title race alive after a tempestuous Merseyside derby.
Frustration turns to jubilation for Liverpool Football Club in the Merseyside derby. It matters a lot locally, but it matters even more at the top of the Premier League.
In Gaelic Games, Barry Carl and Niall Moran are with us to review a weekend of upsets, injuries and intrigue in the Championship.
It is the end. Galway have come to Castlebar and they've won again.
Fantastic win for Galway, and you'd have to give huge credit to, as we said, their defensive system, and so much admiration for Mayo as well, the way they fought back, Dara. What a game. Brilliant way to kick off the Connacht Championship in style in McKay Park today.
Plus, it's the eve of the Punch-A-Sound Festival. We'll get Ruby to preview an exciting few days ahead as Willie Mullins and rivals plot to end the National Hunt season on a high.
It might be his advantage if this dry weather stays going. It might be advantage for Shaq and Perceval. You know, I always have great faith in him. He likes the place. You know, we give him a nice break from Cheltenham, so he'll go there hopefully right. But he's older now, and, you know, he mightn't just be at his best. But Energumene is obviously the one to beat on the day. I imagine Paul won't desert Energumene.
I don't think he did, or he will, and he didn't either. But if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is great to have your company in this Monday evening, wherever in the world you are tuning in from. Shane Dawson here in the company of Ruby Walsh and Alan Colley will be joining us in a few moments' time live in studio, and Stephen Kelly to chat football. But before we do, Ruby, a couple of news headlines, I suppose, that caught my eye today, starting with... what shall we start with, Ruby? Gaelic football. Ladies Gaelic football. The teams of the 2022 Lidl Nationals Football League leagues have been revealed, with champions Meath leading the way in the Division 1 selection. Meath's march to a very first Lidl National League Division 1 title has been rewarded with the inclusion of 7 players on the top flight selection. Beaten finalist Donegal have 4 players honoured. 2021 winners Dublin have 3 players in the team, while there's 1 player from Mayo on this selection. In golf, Ruby, the K Club will host the Irish Open in 2023, 2025 and 2027. DP World Tour chiefs who brokered the agreement also confirmed that the resort's second Arnold Palmer designed course, Palmer South, will also play host to the Challenge Tour's Irish Challenge in the intervening years, beginning this July and again in 2024 and 2026. The announcement continues the momentum surrounding the Horizon Irish Open, with Horizon Therapeutics, the global biotechnology company headquartered in Dublin, having signed a 6-year title sponsorship deal in February, beginning with this year's event at Mount Juliet Estate, which runs from the 30th of June to the 3rd of July. Next year will be just the second time the K Club has hosted the Irish Open, having done so for the first time in 2016, when 4-time major winner Rory McIlroy claimed a famous victory. Ruby, are you a good golfman?
No, it's the next headline. I like, Shane. Keep
okay,
going.
Keep going. I'll keep
Scottish
rattling on.
Football, go on. Keep
okay.
Going. This is the parlour. Peach, this is.
This is the big one as well, and it will go nicely into our football chat with Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly. And that is the news that, according to newspaper reports, Roy Keane has emerged as a potential surprise successor to Sean Maloney as Hibernian manager. The former Cove Ramblers player came close to a return to Sunderland, who he previously led from the Championship relegation players to promotion to the Premier League in February, before talks broke down and Alex Neil was appointed instead. He has discussed the Hibs job with friends, but will be wary of what happened to Maloney, who got the boot after just 120 days, and indeed the departed Jack Ross before him, who were both brutally dismissed by Ron Gordon, the American Hibernian owner. So, Ruby, Roy Keane to Hibs, potentially in the company of Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly. Ruby, what do you make of that?
I think I heard that right, did I? Do you, like, that is unbelievable loyalty to the League of Ireland.
I thought Alan would pick me up on it. And
Roy,
I was like,
Keane, the ex-Cove Ramblers player, that's really what made him famous. And that is...
beyond loyal, Shane. We know you're a huge League of Ireland fan, but you've taken it to a new level this evening, describing Roy Keane as that. Not
it's
Manchester
factual.
United, not Nottingham Forest, not the former Sunderland manager, no.
Celtic, over former Celtic player, Irish international, Irish captain, leader, one of Ireland's greatest ever, ever players might be taking over a job. Listen, I deal in facts, Ruby, and that's a fact.
It is a fact, there was no doubt about that, but it is definitely one you had to do. Well, just dug it out of your own memory, didn't you?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. I was hoping someone might know. So you caught me. You're wise. You always pull me up, Ruby, between that and the other issue with the Cheltenham non-runner. But less said about that, the better. But listen,
it wasn't. Don't worry, Shane, because it was Aintree.
Oh, sorry.
Don't worry about that.
You're on a roll now.
It meant a lot to you, Shane. It meant a lot to you. It cut you deep. I understand that. I can understand. But Alan Colley, can you really see Roy Keane and Hibs?
No chance, Ruby.
It's not the 1st of April, is it?
I was surprised by the headline. I hadn't heard about this, obviously, and Shane just mentioned it to me before we came on air. And I did think a few weeks back, obviously, he was linked heavily to the Sunderland job. And I thought if there was any possibility of him maybe going back into management, the fact that he'd been there, been successful, knew the club, knew the area, knew the surroundings, that there may have been a possibility he'd consider the Sunderland thing. Obviously, it never happened. But I think when you look at Roy Keane at the moment, Ruby, and in terms of... Obviously, we followed him for years as, in my opinion, the best player that we've ever produced. He was my hero growing up, and we all know the stellar career that he had. But if you look at him in recent years, since things haven't worked out for him as such in the management, and he's absolute box office on Sky and almost made that into his own little kind of... he can pick and choose, I think, when he wants to do the matches as well with Sky. So to think he'd go to... Hibernian, there's absolutely no chance, because he's carved out the punditry thing now for himself. He's very good at it. He's box office. Why would you leave the comfy warm studio, Ruby, to go up to cold Scotland with a struggling Hibernian team? I just can't see it at all.
Well, I could understand the challenge, right? There's no doubt about that. But the part that I would see as less likely is Roy Keane at this stage of his life moving to Scotland.
Yeah, not only the move as well, I think, Ruby, obviously the challenge, but I think it's a monumental challenge. I think with the Sunderland thing, we all know Sunderland are a massive club, and the potential that's there to maybe get them back to somewhere where they were, obviously, when he was at the helm, and possibly the Championship in the Premier League. There's certainly an avenue there that you would think, as most managers would probably think and look at the Sunderland job from the outside and think, yeah, there's huge potential here and I could make this work. So I'm sure that challenge probably looked a realistic one on paper. You look at the Hibernian one and it's just a monumental challenge to get them anywhere near challenging with Celtic and Rangers. So as I say, he's quite comfortable. He's carved out that little punditry thing for himself at Sky. Can you see him giving that up for the job in Scotland? Absolutely no chance.
Well, when you're taking any job, we should go in at a low point. So he would be going in at a low level. But look, we're going to go to a high level now. And Alan, I think we should start with the Merseyside derby at the weekend. Liverpool-Everton. It was what an old-fashioned derby should be.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, it was great to see that, Ruby. And I suppose it showed just... certainly the disparity in both clubs at what ends of the table that they're fighting at, because Everton obviously came out to fight and to put up some sort of a challenge. It was the only way they were going to try and resist the onslaught from Liverpool, was to try and slow the game down and upset them and frustrate them. And we saw that obviously with the players getting involved after the Corey's challenge as well, and it did frustrate them for an hour, Ruby, to be fair. Obviously packed the midfield, Lampard as well.
They did better than United did.
They did, and they showed that fight, to be fair to them. Like, no one could accuse them that they're not obviously fighting for the jersey as such. I just think it's a total lack of quality with them at the moment, and they're low on confidence coming because of the results that they've had as well, and Lampard hasn't got that bounce, I suppose, that people would have expected him to get. And now they're right in the mire. Like, you look at the table at the bottom, I speak about the bounce that a manager can get from a club. You look at Burnley, and I was very critical of Burnley last week when I thought it was a major mistake getting rid of Sean Dyche, but they've picked up 7 points out of 9. And that's the bounce that you want.
Is that you admitting you were wrong?
I'd say a lot of people will have to admit they're wrong if they stay up, absolutely, because...
That's a very political answer of yes. Yes is the answer, Ruby, but he's also trying to get more people in with him.
It's not often I would admit I'm wrong.
He's not going down on his own here, Shane. He's not going down on his own.
But to be fair, yeah, I'd say there's a lot of people who'd be in trouble, because I think it was universal, the opinion about Sean Dyche, and people thinking it was a crazy decision. But they'll be proved right if they stay up. And talking about bounces, as I say, 7 points out of 9, they've had an absolutely brilliant week, Burnley. And now, as I say, Everton are right in the mire. I never thought they would get a result against Liverpool yesterday, Ruby. If they were going to get one, it was purely by the fact that they were going to obviously try and frustrate the life out of them. They did have a couple of breakaways. The core, I felt, should have done better. Anthony Gordon, a half chance in the second half as well. But I think Liverpool, to be fair, 83% of the ball. As I said, you look at the stats in terms of the shots on target, I think there was only four, but they absolutely dominated the game, and it was only a matter of time. I felt Seamus Coleman was at fault for the goal as well. If you look at the build up, the first one, when Salah's on it, they're all picking up and he's in the right position, but it looks for a split second as it goes over, I think, Holgate's head. It looks like Jota is going to go to it, and he makes that step to try and close Jota, try to get close to him, and it looks like Jota just ducks down, and Robertson, who he was picking up, comes in at the back post and tucks it away. And once you go 1-0 down, you're chasing the game, then it was inevitable that they may get a second. But I never felt Everton were going to get a result, and I always felt, Shane asked me the question Friday night about Man City and Liverpool, and the answer I gave him was it'll be much the same come Monday in terms of the league table, and that's what we have.
Well, gents, I want to welcome into the conversation Stephen Kelly, and you know, I suppose I refer to Roy Keane as former Cove Ramblers player. I'd like to, I suppose, Stephen Kelly, product of the Belvedere Academy.
You're going all out now, Shane.
And of course, former Republic of Ireland international and Premier League stalwart. Stephen, sticking with the Merseyside derby there as well. Frank Lampard was very annoyed afterwards, and I do want to get your thoughts on Everton's setup to the match and how they approached it. Some people weren't too pleased, but Everton have contacted the Professional Game Match Officials Board with concerns over some of the refereeing in their 2-0 defeat last month. Of course, the club received an apology following another official complaint from PGMOL or Pugmall Chief Mike Riley following the failure to award a handball against Rodri in the home defeat to Manchester City. Is there a genuine fear that the Premier League favour the top teams, or is that complete nonsense and Frank Lampard and Everton should just be getting on with it?
I think there are times when I've played in games and I've absolutely not got stuff. I'm 100%. You're playing at Old Trafford, and this is in time gone by, and you know for a fact you're going there, you're not going to get given anything. But I think it's changed slightly. There's still, every now and again, you feel like there's some favouritism, but you kind of feel with VAR, there should be no reason for this situation ever to occur, because it's been checked, double checked, triple checked, and then, you know, the decision's being made. So at times, you feel it. Like, I think Liverpool played against Forest in the FA Cup, and I felt that they got a couple of decisions that they probably shouldn't have got, and maybe because of the size of the team and because, you know, people want them to go through, that's what happened. But I think it's a lot less so than what it was before. It's just kind of a little bit of biasm that's in. I think referees and stuff, it's in them to for those clubs, because they expect them to get so much. But I think of modern day football, it's a lot less than what it was past. Like before, decisions that we used to be given against us, you'd be pulling your hair out thinking, how has that gone against me? Or how have they been given that? And you know, that was just Fergie screaming from the sideline and the ref would just buckle. But I think there's a lot less of that now than what there was.
Their approach to the game, though, did they bring it on themselves somewhat in terms of Gordon getting booked by diving, and there was a bit of play acting by Richarlison as well? Like, I'm not saying that, you know, every referee should be just, and I know I was very disappointed coming away from a few League of Ireland matches recently in terms of refereeing performances, but in terms of Everton's approach to the game, I mean, they went out to it with not the most proactive approach, I suppose, is a polite way of putting it.
I think they went out with the best approach they possibly could to try and get results. Like, the gulf in class between themselves and Liverpool is astronomical. Like, they're nowhere near them. Like, most teams are nowhere near Liverpool and City. So for Everton to try and get a result, they have to result to try and use every tactic in the book to try and get something out of that game. You know, people criticised Atletico Madrid for the way they went about their business a few weeks ago, and City came through that because City were just a quality side and they were able to get through, and they, you know, even all the underhand tactics, everything went into this game just knowing that they had to stifle them, they had to stop them, they had to slow the game down, they had to try and do everything they possibly could to stop losing to Liverpool. Not only is it a massive derby, but the position it puts themselves in now, they're in the bottom three, so they're fighting for their lives, and you know, at times you do anything to try and get a result, it was never going to be enough because Liverpool are just way better than them, and that's the problem. Liverpool have such good players and they're so far ahead of Everton, and Liverpool have such resolve about them as well. They can get the job done, which is what's so lovely to watch. So as much as people are going, oh, it backfired, I think they had to do everything they had to try and get a result from that game, and I don't think they changed their tactics at all, because it put them within a few opportunities that had it gone their way, it could have been slightly different.
Just on that, Shane, as well, and Ruby, from Stephen's point with the referees, I don't think, and I never felt over the years, referees go out consciously to make decisions to favour another team. But when you're playing in a cauldron like Anfield, the home crowd, a big influential figure like a Van Dijk in your face or a Klopp or somebody like that, they are swayed by that. I absolutely believe that. And I don't think it's a case of you saying, do the bigger teams get the decisions because the referee wants to give the bet? But they are influenced, and I think it takes a really strong character of a referee. Is Stuart Atwell that? I'm looking at him yesterday and kind of thinking... But I do think, definitely, and we've seen that in years gone by, a Ferguson on the line or a Guardiola. I think in that sense, Shane, that it probably happens purely because of maybe the profile of the individuals that we might be dealing with, rather than a referee. I've never once felt a referee has gone out in games I played or games I watched and thought, oh, he's just out to do a team there. I don't think that's fair. Like,
yeah, subconscious, isn't
it? Can't it, lads? Can you not get the wrong side of a referee as well, though? And before you even start, you know he's against you. You could get the wrong side. You could get the wrong side of a steward. You can know before you start that you can't get the wrong side of them either. You can try and influence them, but does the crowd not play a huge part? I mean, the referee at the end of the day is a human. Are they going to react to noise, to crowd, to atmosphere as well, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely. Everything is a factor, and like you said, big characters of the pitch, crowd, noise, atmosphere, you know, what Liverpool are going for, that's all going to play a massive part to influence their decision. But I think what football now should be able to do is that, because there's four guys looking on his computer screen or looking at a monitor watching it now, they should be able to influence the referee and help make the right decision. So the penalty, it's a penalty. I mean, it's one of those things that should have been given. Would have changed the course of the game? I don't think it would have. I still think Liverpool were way too good. They would have won it. But absolutely, he didn't want to give that, because you could tell Gordon had gone down there. He'd gone down and he dove. So that was in his mind as well. So that's you saying influence the decision, making the referee going against him. Like he had already put in his mind. It was like the boy who cried wolf. So he'd already made a tough decision. So I think for me, that you're listening to and you're watching that, and the ref in that position, it has to come down. I think VAR have to step in and make that decision for him, because that's what it's there for.
But Alan, am I the only one that thinks rugby is way ahead here? Ahead of horse racing, ahead of soccer, ahead of them all, with the communication between the TMO and the referee, in that we can all hear their thought process and why decisions are made, and it just clears everything up.
Yeah, I think they're brilliant at it, Ruby, and obviously they were the standard bearers at the start. All the other sports are following, but you mentioned the word there, it's the communication, and we can all hear it. Plus, I always feel when I'm watching, and I don't claim to know an awful lot about rugby, but just from watching the games or watching, as you say, a referee's decision that may come down with a TMO or whatever, I feel there's always a definitive question asked of the TMO, and then he has to make the answer. Is it yes? Is it no? There's such grey areas around the football and when they use the VAR, and I think there's decisions Stephen mentioned there where the referee might make an on-field one, and we could all see that it's wrong and VAR won't get involved, but he should be getting involved in his ear saying, you need to pull this up. And then there's other instances where he's gone over to the monitor to look at, and he's always been almost been influenced by what's being told in the box, and you often see them come back as soon as they look at the monitor and they will go with the decision that's been told from the box. But certainly, to answer your question, Ruby, from the rugby side of things, there's so much we can learn. But I was always against VAR from day one. It has improved slightly this year, but I still think there's major room for improvement on it. But the big thing that separates it for me from the rugby to the football is there's always a definitive question asked of the TMO, and he comes back with his answer and a way to go. And they always seem to get them right.
Sorry, Ruby, I knew you were about to hop in there, but I just want to make the point. I was actually watching a video of the A-League in Australia, and they mic'd up one of the referees, and you could hear his rationale behind decisions and even kind of saying, OK, VAR have changed that, it's not a penalty. He goes, do you know what, will I go over to the monitor and sell it and kind of give it? And it was so refreshing to hear that. And if you actually hear that communication, then as a fan looking on, and your frustration completely subsides, because you can actually hear what's happening.
100%, Shane. And that actually goes back to, even, I'm sure Stephen will tell you this, on the pitch, you might not see a referee communicating with a player, but I've always found the best referees that I've been refereed by are the ones where every player will appeal for a decision and throw their arms in the air and shout or whatever. But we've had a ref over the years, Alan Kelly, in this league, and he'd always actually say to you, look, Alan, he pushed him or he did this. And straight away, as you said, your passion or your frustration subsides, and you can kind of say, all right, well, fair enough, if that's what you thought, and we move on. Like, but it's the ones that almost kind of turn their head against you, frustrate the life out of you. But certainly on that one, Shane, and to go back to Ruby's point about the rugby, the communication is key. And if you can hear the conversation being had, I think it would help massively for everybody.
Stephen, Liverpool won a tense affair, but Man City were just way too good for Watford. 5-1, 21 shots on goal, 74% possession, 701 passes, 88% pass accuracy. They were just in a different league, weren't they?
Yeah, they're just City, isn't it? I don't think it's weird. You're looking at it and you look at the stats and you watch the play, and we've become used to it, which is kind of crazy to think we've become used to how well they play consistently all the time. But some of the passes, like Rodri's goal was ridiculous, but De Bruyne is cross for this second header, like I could just watch that cross all day long. The whip on the ball, I mean, it's the most pinpoint accurate cross you've seen. They're just spectacular, and on their day they're so hard to play against. You know, you didn't give them a prayer against City today. But even when they got that goal back, you thought that's just going to poke the bear, you're going to just wake them up even more here, you probably should try to not get a goal against them so they don't come after you. But they're on a different level, and them and Liverpool, and what's great is they play such contrasting styles of football. So for both teams to be so advanced, so far ahead of everybody else, it's just a credit to the players and the managers. But the consistency level of them is just, I think it's ridiculous.
I thought it was the same. Even the 1-2 with De Bruyne and Jesus for the third goal was incredible too. Alan, Chelsea. Come on, David Moyes felt aggrieved. Was he right or wrong?
Yeah, he probably was. But although if aggrieved, I'm not sure about the result, but certainly the decision, I think it was a red card, Ruby. You know, definitely. You look at Dawson, obviously grabs Lukaku back. If he doesn't grab him back, he's probably going to stick it in the net himself. Although with Lukaku at the moment, maybe he wouldn't. It might have been better letting him run through and hit it over the bar or something with him. He's struggling, but I don't think he can have any complaints about that. No, Jorginho's penalty, the worst penalty I think I've ever seen. And he's a brilliant penalty taker. But even though it's hard to criticise him with the little bounce that he does or the little jump, I hate to see that. Just run up and stick it in the net. Now, I know he's been very good at them, but you look at Bruno Fernandes at the weekend, the same thing. What is it with this, like the new trend, and you run up and take a skip and a jump and just stick it in the net?
I saw a really good actually tweet, and it kind of defined what was actually happening there. And perhaps Jorginho saw Fernandes skew it wide, and that's why he went a bit more central. But if you actually look back at the replay, what Fabianski did just at the very last second, as Jorginho stuck his head up, Fabianski planted his weight on his right foot. So automatically then Jorginho thinks he's going to go one way, then completely changes it in like a millisecond,
but even the skill
and goes across. I mean, it's just excellent goalkeeping, and they're able to read these penalties now because it's happened so often.
Yeah, but even the skill, Shane, to actually what they do when you look at them running up to it, they're not even looking at the ball, they're looking at the keeper. Now that takes a skill in itself to actually look at the goalkeeper and then still be in line to obviously to get a good strike on it. He never got the good strike on it. But to me, if I was a coach or a manager, if I had a player playing, I'd be saying, you run up and you hit it properly like everyone else and you just stick it in the net. Disc, because it comes back to bite you in the bum, the likes of that. You look at Fernandes as well. It's just messing. To me, that's messing.
It is. I think I find this so hard to watch. Honestly, you're watching it going, what is he doing? And the thing is, you know he's been successful with it, so it's almost hard to criticise it. But then when it does go wrong, you're thinking it's the most ridiculous way to take a penalty ever. And listen, I've never taken one in a high-pressure situation before, but if I did, I'm sure I'd just try and put my foot through it. Like, if I was trying to pass the ball to you and I skipped and tried to pass it, you'd be like, what are you doing, Kel? What are you doing? Like,
just put Dennis Irwin videos on the loop. Yeah. Just how you take a penalty.
Put your laces through it.
If an 10-year-old does that, you know, you're giving out to him at the weekend. Yeah. And this trend that's come in with the players, like the Fernandes one as well, like, and there's a fella who's low on confidence. Why would you be even taking any more chances thinking, if I miss this, I'm going to get even more criticised than what I've been getting? So you'd be even... He'd be approaching that for me if I was in that situation, making sure you get the best contact possible on it to give yourself every chance of scoring. Running up and skipping up, and Pogba does the same, this walk up nonsense. It's just pure nonsense.
He just spends the whole time walking. He does nothing but walk.
It's pure nonsense.
Gentlemen.
Now he's walking out the gate. Adam, we can't let you go without mentioning Spurs. Not a shot on target against Brentford.
Stop. I thought I'd go away with it.
No, this is the last word, Steve. This is our ending point as well.
I don't know. It's just I was hopeful that United do us a favour, but there's no chance of that going to them, was there, against Arsenal? But no, it's unbelievable, because they actually, at times, they played some good football. But the thing with the forward line they have, Kulusevski, Benton, Cornell, Flying, Son, Kane, to not have a shot on target two games in a row is criminal, absolutely criminal, with the forward line they have. And you know, teams are just sitting in. I think what teams are doing is they're dropping deep and they're not allowing that space in behind them, which is an obvious way to play against Spurs, because when Kane drops in and he puts Son in behind, when you give them space, they kill you. But they're dropping deep, they're getting numbers in, they're packing, and Tottenham are finding it very hard to break them down when they get numbers behind the ball in congested areas. So teams have kind of figured them out over the last few weeks, but come on, they need to pick up.
And on that note, sorry, we had to throw it at you, Steve. No, we had to throw it at you. There ends our football chat for today, but do stay with us. Lots to get through on the show, but coming up in a few moments' time, we'll be turning our attention to horse racing. Alan Colley, you'll be sticking around to give us your expert opinion.
I'll
on
be
the
in
horses.
Punchestown as well.
And Ruby Walsh, of course, will be giving us a lowdown on Punchestown. So do stay with us.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on.
Racing.
Hello once again, you're very welcome back to Game On this Monday evening as we turn our attention to horse racing now, and specifically the Punchestown Festival, which you can watch live coverage of on RT2 and the RT Player from 4pm Tuesday to Friday, and on RT1 and the RT Player from 2:30 on Saturday, and of course the 2FM Roadcaster will be down there as well. So if you are at Punchestown, be sure to say hello. Ruby Walsh, I'm going to obviously have to leave this up to yourself to give the expert opinion. Alan Colley has stayed on as well, our soccer expert who bluffs his way through a bit of horse racing as well. Ruby, but listen, I know I usually go through today's chronological order, but tomorrow, I suppose, is day one of the Punchestown Festival. It's Champion Chase Day, and indeed is a small field with Willie Mullins leading the charge with Engermain and Chacon Persois in the field.
Alan Colley thinks I'm bluffing when we get to soccer as well, so there's no harm in that. So look, the William Hill Champion Chase, yeah, look, Enogramine versus Chacon Persois, they look the big two. You have Envoy Allen in there as well, who on better ground might run a better race than he ran at Cheltenham. But yeah, it was always going to be a difficult one for Paul Townend to get off Enogramine, no matter how good Chacon Persois has been in the past around Punchestown. And to be honest with you, Shane, the way Enogramine came home at Cheltenham, the way he finished the race off, he was spectacular. I think he'd be very hard to beat in that. There is a couple of other Grade 1 races as well, and Willie Mullins definitely threw a curveball to punters when he declared both Dysart Dynamo and Sir Gerhard in the Vectiv Stud Novices Hurdle at 4:15. Sir Gerhard was very good in the Ballymore Novice Hurdle at Cheltenham over 2 miles and 5 furlongs. He drops back to 2 miles tomorrow to take on Dysart Dynamo, who was probably raced a bit keenly at Cheltenham before falling 3 out. Patrick Mullins takes over on him, Paul Townend's on Sir Gerhard, but that'll be a cracking open in Grade 1 at the Punchestown Festival.
I have a question for you, sorry Alan, before you hop in, just on Sir Gerhard v Dysart Dynamo and that kind of duel that we'll see at 4:15 tomorrow. If Danny was on board Dysart, is he a bit more suited, strongman jockey, to take on a formidable opponent in Sir Gerhard instead of Patrick Mullins?
I wouldn't think so. Patrick has plenty of experience. He won 2 bumpers on Dysart Dynamo. Sean O'Keefe actually won a maiden hurdle on him before Paul got on at Punchestown. So Danny or Patrick would know the horse probably a little bit better than Danny would have, and therefore Patrick could ride him. He won the race last year on Echoes and Rain. So yeah, Patrick has plenty of experience in the Grade 1 race at Punchestown.
That's the race I wanted to ask you a question about, Ruby dear. And you said also that Willie threw a bit of a curveball. So for the likes of that race, and obviously he trains both Sir Gerhard and Dysart Dynamo, who does the final decision come down to as to which race they're going to go to? Is it the owner? Is it Willie? Is it jockey? Is it between the three of them? Or who has the final say?
Well, plenty of people would have a say, but the ultimate decision, Alan, would be Willie Mullins's. And look, Dysart Dynamo ran in the 2 mile race at Cheltenham. You know, he was contemplating stepping him up in trip, but you know, he didn't. He left him at this distance, and he's brought Sir Gerhard back. I would, Alan, imagine trying to find out whether he should stay over hurdles next season to maybe take on Constitution Hill and Honeysuckle, or should he be going novice chasing? I mean, if he can come out on top here and be as dominant over Dysart Dynamo as Constitution Hill was, he has a champion hurdle horse, you know. So it's always looking at the future too. So he's dropped Sir Gerhard back in trip to take on Dysart Dynamo.
So do you still feel as though he doesn't know Sir Gerhard's best distance?
I'd say it's more a decision going forward. I think with very good horses, the distance, you can vary the distance 2 to 2.5. They should be able to cope with both, and likewise at 2.5 and 3 miles, they should be able to bridge both of those gaps. So his distance, I'd say it's more a decision as to what the horse is going to do next year. Mm. Will he stay hurdling or go chasing? And if he's dominant tomorrow, I'd imagine without having an obvious champion hurdle horse in the yard, Willie will keep Sir Gerhard there.
Mm. As always, 51552 is the text number. And Ruby, we've a couple of texts in here. I know you covered Engerman there a bit in the champion chase, but we've a text in from Mike in Cork City. Just briefly, can you ask Ruby his thoughts on Engerman, banker or blowout?
Oh, banker, I would say. I think Shaquem Pourceau can dominate over 2 miles. He has a high cruising speed, he jumps quickly, and he puts horses to the pin of their collar a long way from home. That was okay against horses that wanted further, like Alaho, but I don't think he'd be able to get Erin Gamin on the stretch, and I think he's a banker. As a banker as any chaser can be, no? It's not for that race.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've Kieran and Tip here, who I think by the judge on this hex, he just wants you to do his accumulator for him. So he says, very important question for Ruby, thinking of this accumulator this week. Sir Gerhard, Alaho, Honeysuckle and Facile Vega. Is it a runner or ridiculous? That's from Kieran and Tip. And I'm going to add in an extra option for you, Ruby. Or is it too early to tell?
No, I would say that's a pretty solid bet. But I'd imagine all are going to be well odds on. Alan, you would be better at the maths than me at that. 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. It's probably adding up to, I'm not sure, but I don't know. Is that, wouldn't be my kind of bet now, Shane, to tell you the truth. You okay. need 4 to go and win, and you're only getting pretty skimpy odds.
In terms, Ruby, of obviously Cheltenham being the number one, you have the Christmas Festival now, February as well, the Dublin Festival, and obviously Punchestown, the festivals here at this kind of part of the season. In terms of priorities towards, like, obviously with Willie or Gordon, how much planning goes into this in terms of, as I say, keeping one, obviously Cheltenham being number one, but around the others to keep them all in training to maybe target certain races?
I'd say it's huge, Alan. There's a huge portion of prize money allocated to Punchestown, so it's a very important part of the season. It's a massive festival with great races as well, but it is, you know, the Trainers' Championship is decided on prize money won, and there's a huge amount of it allocated to Punchestown. Mm. So that makes the Punchestown, the Dublin Racing Festival, Leopardstown at Christmas very important meetings if you want to be champion trainer. Like, Willie has chased Gordon Elliott into this meeting on a couple of occasions and been able to win enough in Punchestown to peg Gordon back and beat him. You know, and look, Gordon has done incredible this season. We think he didn't get his licence back, didn't start training again until September. He's had a phenomenal season, and next year will, you know, be back to Willie Mullins versus Gordon Elliott in that sense. But look, it is a huge meeting, Punchestown, and Willie tailors his horse's season that Punchestown is factored in. They don't tend to get to the track until late November, early December, so that they can last until Punchestown in April.
It's been amazing, though, if you look at the record. I suppose Willie Mullins been far away the most successful trainer at the festival since 2017. 57 winners from 347 runners last year as well, breaking his own record for the most winners when winning 19 of the 40 races. That included 9 of the 12 grade ones at the meeting in 2021. But sticking with tomorrow, Ruby, just final one, the novice chase at 25-7. Bob Olinger,
yeah,
I suppose.
Insurance Group champion novice chase. Bob Olinger would look the obvious one. I think it could be hard for him coming back from Cheltenham. I think he'd a pretty tough race there. It could be difficult for him. Maybe Fury Road is value at 6-1, or Capodanno on a drier surface. They would obviously be the obvious two, and I know we're getting tight on time, Shane, so I'll keep rattling on here if Alan wants to jump in. I think the Ladbrokes Punchestown Gold Cup is an incredible race on Wednesday at 5-6. You've Alaho, Clan de Zobo comes from England, Manila Indo, Galvin, Fakir Didari, Album Photo, Janadil and Tornado Flyer. That's an outstanding contest, I think. I think the Irish Mirror Novice Hurdle is very competitive as well. You've the 1-2 from the Albert Bartlett, the Nice Guy in Manila Kakuner. I think the Nice Guy should uphold that form, but Journey With Me of Henry the Bromheads would be a big interest for a lot of people. And then you've got the Champion Bumper as well, American Mike and Facile Vega round 2. I think on a drier track, drier surface, I think Facile Vega could be even more dominant. On Thursday, you've got the Stayers Hurdle. Great to see Paisley Park coming. English runners add a huge amount to the Punchestown Festival, so it's great to see Paisley Park here. Classical Dream will be looking to bounce back from a disappointing run at Cheltenham. And obviously Friday is all about Honeysuckle, going for 16 from 16. I know Game On will be there. The race is at 5:25, so it'll be on just before the show starts. But look, she's an attraction of her own, herself and Rachel Blackmore on Ladies Day at Punchestown. Won't be that big a field, but you know, I think she'll make it 16 from 16 before the festival rounds out on Saturday, where Vauban could back up his triumph win in the Champion 4-year-old hurdle, and Epitant could be hard to beat in the Mayor's hurdle.
beautifully surmised, Ruby. So much to look forward to. As I say, it goes to post tomorrow, runs until Saturday, and you can see all the action live on RT television. And indeed, the roadcaster with 2FM Game On will be down there. And indeed, two Johnnies, I believe, are down in Punchestown as well. And Alan, you'll be down there as well.
Alan's there as well. Don't forget to give Alan a mention. He's coming.
He's
a big draw. Well, he hung on, so you have to. Well, listen, Alan, we'll let you go. Thanks for popping into the studio to chat all things football. And horse racing, Ruby, you and I will be turning our attention to hurling in a few moments' time. So do stay with us, folks.
RTE 2FM. Game On. On 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game On.
Hurling.
Well, welcome back to Game On. So last weekend saw the second round of fixtures in the All-Ireland Hurling Championship, and down in Munster, Limerick faced Waterford in the Gaelic grounds, and I'm sure a happy Niall Moran joins us on the line after watching his Limerick beat what many people perceive to be the biggest dangers, Niall.
How are you doing, Ruby? How are you doing there, Shane? Brilliant evening in Limerick. Real great occasion, real sense of occasion, real family occasion, I suppose. Maybe in recent years we've probably been probably given a homecoming to the Limerick team, but to be fair, I think they offered up a bit of a homecoming on Saturday night, and very, very impressive. I know maybe only 3-point winners in the scoreboard, but it felt like a lot more despite the late scare, so they'll be very, very happy, and it puts them in a nice position halfway through the round robin.
Oh, I'm sure it does. That said, the only scare probably is Keane Lynch. He went off with what looked like a hamstring injury early enough, Niall, and look, I'm not a hurling genius, but even I enjoy watching Keane Lynch playing, and any word on him or when he might be back?
He's a maestro. I haven't kind of been privy to it, but look, I'd say it was more so a concern, and I would hope that it's probably a kind of lower grade strain or tear or whatever else, and so the hope would be that he'd be back into the closing stages of the Munster Championship should Limerick get on. But so the key to it was, I think his two club mates really dictated the game at various junctures, like Dermot Burns when Limerick were under cash that night. He was just immense, as he has been really all year. Probably, to me, so far this year, I think it's probably been his best year. And that's saying something, given the nature of the few years we've been put down. But he looks like, if Declan Hannan were to ever step aside, he really looks like the next captain in waiting. And his striking ability is just second to none. And I suppose a little bit like Bryson DeChambeau on the golf, like he belittles the ball. And I suppose then Aaron was just in top form. But again, Aaron is that kind of a championship player. He takes a while to get going during the year, but he has risks that you die for. So just there was a huge amount of positives for Limerick. Again, very defensively, very solid at the back. I suppose you saw someone like Stephen Bennett, again, frustrated for much of the game. Austin probably frustrated for much of the game as well. So there's a lot of positives, and obviously Colin Neal coming on then as well. He's given that a bit of an option with Keane probably to go for next match or two. You'd hope to see Colin maybe come in and maybe lay a stake for his place.
Certainly ominous signs, Niall, when you see Keane go off, and even with Kyle Hayes lost in the build-up, Jamie Flanagan and Peter Casey didn't start the championship run for Limerick, and then Dermot Burns and Aaron Glant, it was 19 points between them. Like, I mean, they're going to definitely be pressing on. But from a Waterford point of view, like, I was chatting to Shane McGrath on the Friday evening in the preview, and he kind of mentioned that Liam Calby would have been targeting this now for many, many months. This was a big one that Waterford really wanted a good showing. They've come up short again. Cal mentioned after he's disappointed would be a massive understatement. How big of a blow is this result to Waterford from a round robin standing in Munster, and also mentally as well, just not being able to get over Limerick?
From a round robin standing, I wouldn't be as concerned about it. From a mental point of view, I kind of would. Again and again, like, I suppose psychologically Limerick have probably held the cash over that Waterford team the last couple of years, and so the feeling was, okay, Limerick could afford to lose it and carry on without having any implication. But again, Waterford was up against that Limerick team, and they probably were well beaten. I know they could spin it and say, look, we showed great spirit only for a dropping of a ball near the end. If the ball dropped into the square, we could have maybe drawn the game and got something out of it. But I think a couple of things probably conspired against Waterford on Saturday. Not that they've been to in the Figueres or whatever, but Waterford have never really liked coming to Limerick. Again, I know when you're building a team, you put those things to aside, they're extrinsic factors, but history doesn't lie. I think playing with such a wind in the first half, I think it actually upset Waterford in the sense that it didn't allow them to play their normal running off the shoulder game plan. And I think maybe they found themselves delivering a lot of ball wastefully in the first half. And again, I just think, look, Limerick pushed up on the puckouts, and I had maybe said last week, I think the distribution on puck outs is an area when Waterford go to try and cross over that bridge of winning in All-Ireland. I do think when the pressure comes on, your goalie just has to be razor sharp. And again, with Nicky, he was just immense for Limerick. People will argue that Limerick lost their best player through injury on Saturday, and I wouldn't disagree with it. But I still come back to the most important player in that Limerick team being Nicky Quaid. And again, I think that ultimately, to me, is probably the difference between those two teams at the moment.
Would that have been what Liam Cahill meant when he said we're a work in progress but we'd have to question our decision making? Was it as simple as just the decisions the goalkeeper is making with the puck outs?
I can't speak for his mind, and I'm sure there were things that were done on the pitch, Ruby, no different to any of us. I'm sure when you lose, you can see a lot more issues. But just for me as a spectator, and again, I'm not speaking about the workings of the Waterford dressing room, but in Stephen O'Keefe, you have one of the best goalkeepers in the country, and he is not in the Waterford squad at the moment. And that's no disrespect again to Shane O'Brien. It wasn't that he was poor. It wasn't that he was anything but. But again, just when you have a goalkeeper that is able to pull off the X factor, and that's what Stephen O'Keefe can do, I think you can, when you're trying to break into winning in All-Ireland, I think you can ill afford to be without anybody. And that for me is just, it's an area going forward. But look, Waterford are still going to be there at the business end. This won't derail them. The only issue that is, and like Shane said, psychologically, when they go to play Limerick and could possibly be in All-Ireland semi-final, okay, what will their mindset be? And I suppose John, no old kind of bad memories that kind of come back into lads sometimes when they're faced with a nemesis like Limerick.
The other game in Munster, of course, was Tipperary and Clare. Tipperary were runaway winners, really, 3-21 to 2-16. Clare, actually, were runaway winners, not Tipperary. I think I said Tipperary. But Clare was all about the returning hero. Shane O'Donnell, man of the match performance. Anthony Daly wasn't sure. What did you think?
I thought he played very, very well, to be honest. I thought it was a real team display. I looking at the game in real time, I couldn't really decide for myself to say who was man of the match. I think that's probably the most pleasing aspect for Brian Lohan, in that it wasn't just a TK show. And Tony is still very, very good, but the workload is spread around. And like, they will take beating. Even though next week now they're going to Tyrlis to play in Cork team under pressure. And Clare will, you know what I mean, they'll be full of life after it. And like, they have excellent forwards, very good midfield. And like, John Cannon was excellent yesterday again at six, really, really excellent at six yesterday. Possibly if I was to go for a man of the match, it probably would have been John. And kind of Cleary is solid as full back, but I do think the challenge coming against Cork will be far stronger than what ultimately was a very, very limp Tipperary display. And having watched Tip in the flesh last Sunday, that was my fear for them. I thought psychologically they put a lot into that Waterford game, and I think ultimately, again, I don't think the scoreline was a fair reflection of how far they actually were off Waterford, even though they could have won the game. And look, Colin Bonner, to be fair to him on the line, he was doing his best to kind of get lads going, but he had a lot of guys that were just, they weren't really up to the standard to be expected of Tipperary hurlers. And look, that's no different than any other county. They're in that transition mode, and it does take time to get to that level. So would it be this year for Tipperary? I can't see it.
Do you put that down to transition? Because I wanted to kind of, I suppose, pick your brain on that in terms of how bad Tipperary. You mentioned it was a limp performance, but I mean, they just weren't at it. Like, how worried would you be with that performance if you were Colin Bonner? Like, given the fact that this could be put down to transition, but still you want a showing. You're at home in Semple Stadium as well.
You are at home in Semple Stadium, and from outside you'd always say, oh, Tipperary should have a particular standard of hurler. But I think you really maybe examine Tipperary, and again, look, I'm not privy to the workings of it. We have a close alliance here in our house with Tipperary, but I think at underage, the teams they've been producing and the standard of individual hurler they've been producing aren't really of the standard that you'd associate with Tipperary. And like, I suppose the last real, as I'd call them, Tipperary hurlers that seem to have broken into that team are probably going back to like Sir Jason Ford, Rowan Maher. And so that said, with the greatest respect, what we expect out of a Tipperary hurler. And even though Liam Cahill kind of pilfered to All-Irelands, and you know, Cork ultimately were a far better team individually, and I think Tip at the moment just not going through a rut of having that standard of individual hurler. And then I think there may be a county that needs to re-examine maybe some of their underage structures. You know what I mean? Like, so they haven't been getting the success that you'd normally associate with one of Ireland's top three, and that's not an overnight solution. And to be fair to Colin Bonner, he's doing the best at what he has. I think even previous incumbent Liam Sheedy would be the first to acknowledge that he wasn't able to try some of these guys because he felt that maybe they weren't of that Tipperary standard. So look, you've to admire Colin Bonner for what he's given, and it's just, look, it takes a little bit of time, and there has been a bit of a clear out this year, and with that then that can take 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned it's going to be a big one in Thurles between Cork and Clare, and then the following Sunday Tip have to face Limerick in Limerick as well, so it's not going to get any easier for Colin Bonner's men. Moving on to the Leinster Championship, and Kilkenny and Galway are comfortable winners. We'll touch on that in a moment, but Dublin, massive win over Wexford. Just how good were Matty Kenny's men getting a win down in Wexford 2-0?
Again, you're trying to pick it up from watching the clips on television, and so the first thing I said there, Shane, is I just think they're doing a total disservice to Leinster there at the moment. Like, as in, so the main focus of hurling people was on probably Limerick and Waterford on Saturday evening, and it was as if you're trying to squeeze the Leinster Championship in. And I think ultimately, really, what you're doing for the promotion of the game is you're really murdering it. And again, maybe it's a lesson awaiting for the Tazman Cup that's coming, but if that's how we promote our Leinster Championship, a superb championship, like that game kind of went in under the radar. But look, that won't bother Matty Kenny. They really showed resilience. Like, they got off to a good start and they held on at the end. Dublin have a very, very athletic team, a lot of very, very good hurlers, a lot of actually probably more stickmen now than what they might have actually had a couple of years ago. And I suppose, again, none more so than Donald Burke. He's shooting the lights out every day. Like, he's a 4 or 5 point in play in most games. He's playing a 9-8 or 9-3, and when you have a forward like that and then you have guys like Conor Annan at the back that is one of the top fullbacks in the country, like, they'll still take beating, but it probably puts Wexford under pressure to get a victory against Brian Cody's Kilkenny. And Kilkenny looks like a team that are enjoying being in the shadows of the championship at the moment, because they're getting their house in order, and again, he threw up a big score against Leash, and I wouldn't be disregarding that, because Leash might be weaker. When you see 2-4 scores, they are a team that would take a lot of beating as the championship gets into Ireland quarterfinals, semifinals.
Can you see Wexford getting a result against Kilkenny? I mean, they were lucky. Galway as good as gave them a draw last week, and Dublin nipped them this week. Both games in Wexford. Can you honestly see them troubling Kilkenny the way they're playing at the minute?
So it's the question that you're asking, Ruby. If you were asking me this question a month ago, the best team in Leinster a month ago was Wexford. So I suppose, look, the wheels probably come off the wagon after the league final a little bit. They got a great result against Galway, but I suppose the manner of their performance would have concerned them. And really, with Dublin coming to town, that's a game that they would have been expecting to get 2 points at four. It's tricky, but that Wexford team will have no major problem playing Kilkenny either. They still think that they'll be every bit as good as them. But do I see them getting a result? I don't, because I just think Kilkenny are going to be that little bit strong, and that ultimately leaves them on 1 point from six against the three top teams. And I think that's a huge win for Dublin, because they want to pick up the 4 points in the other games. Two more points against Westmeath. So I think 6 points looks to be the magic number in Leinster, and I don't see Wexford getting to that.
Okay, well, Niall Moran, thank you very much. A really, really entertaining weekend of hurling last weekend, and more to come this weekend. We will be chatting hurling a little bit later in the week as well. Niall Moran, as always, thank you very much. But do stay with us, because we're going to be continuing our Gaelic Games chats from hurling to Gaelic football. Do stay with us.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
So, our Gaelic Games chat continues as we turn our attention to Gaelic football in the company of Barry Cahill. And Barry, if we start with Ulster football, it was Corrigan Park of Nowhere that inspired Cavan to win over Antrim, according to Mickey Graham. But I want to get your thoughts on Donegal Armagh, a match that was marred, I suppose, because of the suspensions and everything else. But we are able to talk about the football. And it was Donegal's old guard who came strong against a wasteful Armagh, 116-12 point winners.
Yeah, big win for Donegal. A team that's probably underachieved a lot over the last 2 to 3 years. I really thought they were going to be Dublin's main contenders there a couple of years ago, but a couple of setbacks. But I think yesterday's result and performance really puts them back into the All-Ireland race. I was very impressed with their performance, particularly, as you mentioned, the older guys there, Michael Murphy, Ryan McHugh, Paddy McBurty, all came to the fore. And yeah, I think that win is really going to give them a boost and a lot of confidence going into the Ulster semi-final against Cavan. They'll be looking for revenge from the Ulster final defeat to them from 2 years ago. So I think, you know, the pathway towards an All-Ireland series, quarter-final, semi-final, has certainly opened up a little bit for them. But really yesterday, I think, was a significant win for that group of players, certainly.
As much as it will be a huge boost and wholly positive for Donegal, on the flip side for Armagh, they failed to step up when it was needed yet again. How big of a setback will that 7-point defeat be?
It is a setback, Shane. I mean, they obviously would have been targeting this game from a long way out. They did start the league campaign particularly well, but probably faded a little bit over the last few games and maybe weren't going to the game as much confidence as they had back in January, February time. And really, their record and pedigree winning the Ulster Championship over the last few years have been very poor. They have done well in the back door. But I think targeting this game yesterday was a big thing for Kieran McGeaney and his management team and players. And really, they just never got going at all. It was a very disappointing performance. And I think certainly their confidence will be shot now over the next couple of weeks, going back into training and getting ready for the back door. But, you know, there's not going to be any easy games in the back door this year. It's obviously a condensed championship and there's a lot of teams will be going into the Tailteann Cup. So they really need to get back on form as quickly as possible if they are to have any sort of say come the latter stages of the All-Ireland Series this year.
Speaking of never getting going, Barry, could the same be said of Mayo at McHale Park?
Yeah, their performance was very patchy. Now, look, they certainly weren't firing and it wasn't the Mayo team that we'd seen from a couple of years ago, but I wouldn't be overly concerned. They were missing guys from injury. Killian O'Connor obviously got a full game under his belt, which will be a benefit to them. Oisin Mullen had to go off injured. I'd still be relatively confident that Mayo will be there or thereabouts in the latter stages of the championship. I think the victory was more important from a Galway perspective because, you know, similar to Donegal, I think they have massively underachieved over the last couple of years in the All-Ireland Series and particularly in the Connacht Championship. So for Pádraig Joyce and his players, it was very much a significant win, beating the Mayo team, who have been All-Ireland contenders, beating them in Castlebar. I think there's more to come out of this Galway team now that they've got this type of victory under their belt.
I really enjoyed Kieran Whelan's analysis last night where he highlighted the double sweeper that Galway was playing or Pádraig Joyce was playing with Galway. That brought about huge improvement. Well, Kieran highlighted it to me and I could see it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we flagged it probably about a month ago in that they have the score and talent and they probably will always rack up a score that's good enough to win a game and win a big game. But the real issue and concern for them was their defensive setup, and I think their structure was a lot more compact yesterday, and it just means that they're able to keep teams to a lower scoreline and also gives a bit more freedom to the likes of Conroy in midfield, Shane Walsh, Damon Comer, these guys up front who can do the damage. But, you know, I think it was probably Heaney's goal that ultimately separated the sides. But I think for Galway going back into training this week, they'll have a pep in the step. The only thing is they're coming up against a very good Roscommon team, so they can't really get too far ahead of themselves. Roscommon have had their number.